Cold mornings, frosty windows. Yep, it's that time of year. So treat yourself and start your day with a cup of fresh roasted Sterling Roastery coffee, sourced from around the world and roasted multiple times a week for unbeatable freshness. It's the kind of warm-up every sports fan deserves this holiday season. And right now, you can win one of three $50 Sterling gift cards, perfect for gifting or building your own winning lineup of Java in the morning. Enter today at sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways so you can wake up, warm up, and Sterling up this holiday season. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways.
125 defining moments, one legendary league. This is Darren Hayes of the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, and a great book is out right now, NFL Moments, 125 Icons and Stories That Define the NFL. It's a definitive visual history of the National Football League, packed with iconic images and untold stories behind the game's biggest plays and its greatest players. From the early legends like Red Grange to today's stars like Patrick Mahomes, this book is a touchdown for fans who crave more than just stories. So give your football bookshelf a Hall of Fame upgrade or snag a holiday gift for that NFL history buff on your shopping list. Pick up NFL Moments, available now at your favorite bookseller. You're just in time for a great adventure going back in time in football history as we talk about one of the greatest historians of all time. Timothy Brown of Football Archaeology takes us on one of his famous tidbits, and you're going to love this story.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com. Welcome once again to the Pig Pen, your portal of positive football history. And welcome to Tuesday on FootballArchaeology.com's Timothy P. Brown visits us to tell us about one of his recent tidbits. Tim, welcome back to the Pig Pen.
Hey, Darren. Good to see you. You know, normally I try to come up with a stupid dad joke at this point, but I'm not going to do that. Instead, I'm going to ask you to imagine. Can you imagine Wisconsin hiring a backup tackle from Princeton to become their head coach, to become the Badgers head coach this coming year? Can you imagine that?
Can I imagine that? Well, I guess I probably could because I don't follow Wisconsin as closely as you do. So now if you said Penn State or Notre Dame, then maybe, you know, Ohio State, maybe I'd recognize that, you know, as being very mythological.
Who's Penn State? Penn State is what? Yeah. So, I mean, the reason I ask that is because that's exactly what happened in 1893. So there's this guy, Park H. Davis, who, you know, I mean, pretty much anybody who's into, like, really old-time American football history is going to know who Park H. Davis is. Yeah, but for those who don't, you know, who aren't familiar with him, he's probably really the first true football historian. I disagree with him on a couple of things, but the fact of the matter is he was the guy who kind of established football history. You know, maybe you could credit that to Camp, but either way, you know, Park H. Davis was for sure wrote one of the, you know, his 1911 football, the intercollegiate game is one of the storied books of,
it's,
you know,
like
American
the Magna Carta
history.
Of football history.
Yeah, yeah, good. Yeah, good, good. Magna Carta. I like Magna Carta. So anyways, he played at Princeton. But at best as I can tell, you know, I went back and tried to look at game reports and everything, you know, because they used to always have the lineups. And as far as I can tell, he's pretty much of a backup player. Now, he started a game here or there, but he's playing for one of the top three teams, four teams in the country, which is understandable, you know, but nevertheless, he's a backup. So he graduates in 1893, spring of 1893, gets a job with like a Philadelphia newspaper, but either he didn't like it or just decided to go into the football world. And he takes off and he takes a job as the head coach at Wisconsin. And, you know, so that was a time when the Eastern football schools, for the most part, followed the graduate coaching model, which meant that mostly the guy who was the coach, the captain the previous year, stuck around for the fall and acted as like a coach, the advisory coach of the team. The guy who ran the team was the captain. You know, the captain made the you know, roster decisions, made the on the field decisions, but the coach was more of an advisor. And of course, subject to personalities and, you know, whatever. So, but if you weren't from out east, you're someplace like Wisconsin or Kansas or wherever, you had to hire some guy from out east to teach you how to play football and teach your kids how to play football, because they didn't know. You know, it was still a new game and it was dominated by the folks in the east. So Wisconsin hires this guy, Park Davis. And so the interesting thing is, like, even if you look at the newspaper coverage of the time, it kind of sounds like there were some things where Davis was running the show. In other times, the captain was running the show. So it was more of a trade-off between the two. But it sounds more like the captain ran the show than Davis did, even though he's the head coach. Plus, Davis started at right tackle in every game of the year. So here he is. He's, you know, played 4 years at Princeton. He's the coach at Wisconsin, but he's also starting at right tackle. Now, sometimes when injuries occurred, then he played left halfback. You know, so, you know, it was just a different game, a different time. And it's not like he's not the only guy who did that. You know, Amos Lonzo Stagg played at Yale, then he coached at Springfield YMCA, and then he goes to Chicago in 1892, and guess what he did the first couple of years? He played for Chicago, right? You know, so it wasn't an unusual thing for the coach to play, the hired professional coach to play. So, I mean, it's just one of those things. It's kind of a crazy deal that's what happened. But, you know, so he ends up, you know, they ended up 4-2 that year. They lost to Chicago Athletic Club, which is a, you know, pretty powerful club. I think, I'm pretty sure, what's his name? The big dude, the big guard from Heffelfinger. Puff, I think Heffelfinger. I think he played for them at times. Maybe, I don't think he played in that game. But, you know, that was a very strong, you know, mostly, you know, former college player team. And so they beat Wisconsin pretty handily. Wisconsin did real well most of the season, but then they met Minnesota, and Minnesota massacred them. So, you know, it's just one of those things where, you know, Davis was successful, and yet, like most of the graduate coaches of the time, he was there for the season, and boom, he's gone, right? And he ends up coaching Amherst the next year. Then he coaches Lafayette for 3 years after that, one of which he is credited as being the national champion because they beat Penn in part by having Fielding Yost, the future Michigan coach and AD, play as a ringer for them. For one game. And guess who named them as national champ? Mark H. Yost, the same guy who was the head coach. So, you know, now they may well have been one of the best teams, but I'm going to kind of say that it didn't hurt that the guy who named them was the coach. So anyway, it's again one of those things, just crazy standards compared to today. And I mean, on the one hand, I respect the hell out of Davis in terms of his research and all kinds of things. I disrespect him from his from the standpoint of him saying the first football game was in 1869 with Princeton and Rutgers, but he's a Princeton alum, so yeah, yada yada. But still, top-notch, top-notch guy, cannot argue with that. He obviously coached a very fine team at Lafayette, despite the ringer. I mean, they had to be really good to play Princeton or to play Penn and beat them. Can't argue with his coaching skill, et cetera. But anyway, it's just one of those things where the standards of the day are rather different from now. And, and he fit into them and he did, he did well, and he's a big, accomplished author, and he was a lawyer. I mean, this was not his day job. He was a lawyer and successful, and but he stuck around and in Easton, after coaching at Lafayette, and was a big supporter of both Lafayette and Princeton, his alma mater, for years, for decades. So I gotta love a guy like that.
Yeah, most definitely. Now I mean, people complain about, Eastern bias in college football today's standards. You had, probably the two biggest names of announcing, Camp and his All-American teams of, often accused of Eastern bias, and
Well,
Davis.
no, not accused. Eastern bias, for sure.
Okay, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
And Mark H. Davis with his retroactive national champion things. You look at some of these compared to, there's you got a whole bunch of, Holgate, and you probably got five or six different major groups or people that have gone down, Billingsley and Park H. Davis, going back and naming who the national champions are because they didn't have it, for the first, what, 30 years or so. And you'll see everybody's sort of in line with whose is, and all of a sudden, a team that has like a two-loss Harvard becomes a national champion. You have all these undefeated teams. By today's standards, we would be like, what the heck are you talking about here? But who knows? He was there closer to it than I was or you were, and
Well,
maybe he had some insight that we don't know, but it sure looks kind of suspicious on some of them.
so I will say this about like a lot of the folks who name national championships, even the ones that the from the old days, the ones that the NCAA identifies or accepts. A lot of them were based on some kind of mathematical formulas, though the formulas aren't really that good.
The Dickinson and
Yeah. But I will say this, for sure about Davis. He was a meticulous researcher. He went out there, and you could argue that he was wrong about this year or that year, including his own team, but he went back and he researched and talked to people who were there, right? Because he's old enough to be there, right? So he talked to people who were there, who understood the game at the time, and compared notes and said, Harvard was better than Princeton this year, or Harvard was better than Yale, or Harvard was better than Syracuse, or whatever it was. And as much as I kind of make fun of him for the Lafayette decision, I think I probably trust his view on championship teams as much as anybody else's. Mathematical formulas, while generally, like nowadays, I really do trust them, right? Because of intersectional play and things like that. But back then, I mean, I think he probably had it as right as anybody could possibly have gotten it right.
Yeah,
I mean, to his credit, I mean, I think he has probably the 1911 intercollegiate game book. The details he has of each of those early seasons is impeccable. You couldn't find it in a newspaper. I mean, whether he's right or wrong, he has a written history of all these seasons that nobody else has ever put together that I've seen from that era, the way he did it. Calling out players. But I think maybe the biggest thing is some of the images he has in that book that he identified probably have been lost to history. When I believe he has like Harvard McGill images from that meeting of that May 14th and May 15th.
Yeah, he does. Yeah.
Photography was barely, it was a juvenile at best at that time. And here's his images of this that he's identified and saved for, so we can look at, 140 years later, and it's identified that way. So that's one thing.
And it's out of copyright, so I can steal those images and put them into my own, my stuff.
Yeah, me too.
I make fun of them in certain respects, but hey, I bow to the man. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, that's definitely true. So, and he has, it's a great story. The Penn and Lafayette story and Fielding Gillis, of all people, what he went on to do afterwards is just such a great legend of the game. It's fun to tell and fun to listen to multiple times. But, Tim, you have a lot of different aspects of the history of football that are fun, that are interesting, that maybe people don't know because it's, 140, 150 years, earlier in our past. And you do this in your tidbits on football archaeology. But maybe you could share with the listeners how they can take in some of these.
Sure. The easiest way is just go to footballarchaeology.com. It's a Substack site. Subscribe. Every time I publish something, you'll get an email that covers that information. Otherwise, follow me on Blue Sky or just bookmark Football Archaeology and go there and search around whenever you want. There's a search function. So if I don't know how much people actually appreciate it, but if you want to search some old stupid football thing, just put it into the search function there and there's a chance that I've covered it at some point.
All right. Well, Tim, we really appreciate you sharing the history, doing the research, and coming on sharing it with us each and every Tuesday. We'd love to talk to you again next week.
Very good, sir. Thank you.
That's all the football history we have today, folks. Join us back tomorrow for more of your football history. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
You did not see their faces on the Wheaties boxes, nor did they have the headlines, but they were breaking barriers, one pitch at a time. The integration of minor league baseball, a history and player register, 1946 to 1959, by Rick Swain and Gary C. Fink, shines a light on the overlooked heroes who paved the way for future legends. From dusty bus rides to hostile crowds, these players fought for a place in a game that did not want to see them win. More than history, it's a tribute to courage, perseverance, and the power of a game to change. Honor their legacy today and grab a copy of The Integration of Minor League Baseball at your favorite bookseller.